What draws people to live and work in Wisconsin? We all have different reasons, but for many people, it's the precious resources that make the state a wonderful place to live. The land, the water, the food. They support our lives and our economy. But what does that mean for the future of Wisconsin if we change the way we use these resources, just as people's own needs and tastes evolve?
We're introducing people to cranberry. So when we go into, whether it's Western Europe or the UK or Asia, they don't even have words for cranberry, and they don't know what they are. So we have to tell them what the fruit is and then convince them to eat it.
This year, WPR has been reporting on our natural resources through the State of Change series. And today, we look toward the future. Where is the cranberry industry going? What about the future of foreign land ownership? And what are we going to do with all that manure? Find out this hour on State of Change. But first, the news. This is State of Change from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're looking at the future of food, water, and land. First, land. Not all the farmland in Wisconsin is owned by Wisconsinites. It's not even all owned by Americans. In fact, there are a number of farms owned by foreign interests from places like Germany, Belgium, and Italy. That's according to data published by the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. Foreign ownership of land has shot up in Wisconsin and across the country. But as Bridget Bowden reports, enforcement of the federal and state laws that regulate foreign ownership of farmland is lax. And because of that, we probably don't know how much land is owned by foreign interests.
Foreign companies that own agricultural land in the United States are required by federal law to report it to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But it's self-reported and rarely enforced, so the database of foreign landowners contains errors and omissions. For example, the records show 8,700 acres in Manitowoc County, valued at more than $19 million. The land was acquired by a Canadian company or person in 2014. But the space where the owner should be listed is blank. It doesn't say where the land is. So I went to Manitowoc County to see if I could find it. I've been driving around all afternoon looking for this land. There are almost a million acres in this county, and I haven't seen any Canadian flags or other signs that I might be looking at foreign-owned land. I thought someone in the county government might know where the land is, so I called the Register of Deeds.
Good morning, Register of Deeds. Kiel speaking.
Hi, I'm Bridget. I work for Wisconsin Public Radio, and I'm trying to track down a piece of land in the county. Without the owner's name or the location of the land, there wasn't much they could do for me.
If I just had a little bit, even an idea of where in the county it was, but because you don't have that idea, I mean, it's like a needle in the haystack for me looking.
She transferred me to the county planning and zoning office, and with the information that I had, they couldn't help me either. A few things could be happening here. Maybe the land was sold, and that wasn't reported to the USDA. Maybe there was a typo in the report. Maybe the land is broken up into multiple parcels. It's hard to know. And for Joe Maxwell, that's a problem.
We don't want to scare people, but the fact is their countryside is being bought up by foreign interests, and we don't even know who they are.
Maxwell is the executive director of the Organization for Competitive Markets, a nonprofit that focuses on antitrust and trade policy in agriculture. He says the problem with the record keeping is that it's hardly ever enforced.
Many people just don't do it. So while we have a database, it does not properly reflect the overall investment by foreign interests.
Between 2004 and 2010, the USDA issued 187 fines. Since 2011, there were only 10 fines, with none in the last 3 years. Maxwell says who controls our farmland could be a security issue, especially when countries like China, Russia, or Saudi Arabia purchase land here.
Food is as important to us as a society as is energy. So when food is controlled by others, it becomes a national security issue.
U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Debbie Stabenow of Michigan have sponsored a bill that would add the Secretary of Agriculture and the Secretary of Health and Human Services to the Committee on Foreign Investment. The bill hasn't yet received a hearing. Maxwell says the bill is a start, but he'd like to see more thorough records of foreign landowners first.
We would like real solid, tough, stronger punishment for failure to report.
And he'd like to see states regulate the amount of land that foreign interests can own. In Wisconsin, foreign individuals and companies can't own more than 640 acres of land, with some exceptions. But according to the data reported to the USDA, some may have more than that. Troy Schneider is an agricultural lawyer in Chilton.
I think that law was more designed for like big companies coming in to purchase land and kind of swallowing up, you know, all of our cheap land, you know, so, you know, relatively speaking.
A few years ago, there was an effort to get rid of the state law that limits acreage, but it didn't pass.
I think it's really interesting that the laws exist and are out there, but really not really followed. You know, it's almost like the 35-mile-an-hour zone on the back road, you know, where everybody drives 55 anyways.
In a way, he's right. The state law hasn't been enforced a single time, at least since 2004. In that same period of time, foreign land ownership increased by 500%, and there's no sign that it's slowing. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
As we just heard, foreign interests are buying more and more land in Wisconsin. But what about those people closer to home who are looking at getting into the business? The average farmer in Wisconsin is getting older and older. The person running the farm day to day, well,
half of them are over the age of 55. That's according to the USDA's Census of Agriculture. As these farmers consider retirement, they have to start thinking about what to do with the land and their business. Some farmers will hand the farm down to their children or other family members. If the family isn't interested in dedicating their life to agriculture, the farmers could look towards selling the farm to another family or a corporation. Farms can be expensive, in the millions. And for the increasing number of young farmers trying to enter the industry, land can be nearly impossible to afford. And as the industry ages, young farmers are needed more than ever. While there are many ideas floating around on how to address this issue, one solution is mentorships. At a dairy farm in Dodgeville, about 200 cows are having their morning meal, grazing on grass, happily chewing away. And once they're milked later in the afternoon, that milk will go towards creating award-winning cheeses on site.
My passion is grazing dairy cows and making milk from pasture. It's a philosophy. It's a part of who I actually am.
Scott Marika is co-owner of Grass Dairy and Uplands Cheese, where the cow's diet almost exclusively comes from pasture. The 32-year-old dairy farmer bought the operation with his cheesemaking partner, Andy Hatch, in 2014. The duo spent years working with the previous owners, doing the daily chores, learning the farm's quirks, and building equity.
You know, here I am today running my own business, and, you know, I work where I live. I have my family I can see whenever I want, and it's a beautiful business, and I love it. I wouldn't change anything I've made, any decisions I've made.
Now, Marika is, in a way, paying it forward. He's hosting an aspiring farmer through the Dairy Grazing Apprenticeship, or DGA. It acts like a matchmaking service, partnering master farmers with people wanting to enter the business. It's his friend, Matt Nielsen, who, like Marika, did not grow up in a farming family. Nielsen has toyed with the idea of becoming a farmer since he was a kid, but before settling down, he had to get some things out of his system.
I've been living in Chile the last couple of years, took a big bike trip, and have just kind of like seen what I wanted to see. Now I'm ready to. But that agitation was always in the back of my mind, calling me to maybe I should try for dairy farming again. I kind of found myself all throughout my travels and everything, still reading about dairy farming, still trying to download publications about cheese making and all these things. Like, well, what am I putting it off for anymore?
Now that he's ready to dive in, Nielsen decided that going through the DGA was the best way to prepare himself to be a farmer.
Yeah, and I always knew that if I was going to get a good start in dairy farming, that I knew nobody who was more knowledgeable and enthusiastic about it than Scott. Like, I'd come visit them.
Enthusiastic, I don't know about knowledgeable.
Well, I'd come visit them just because we were friends, and I'd kind of always pick his brain a little bit, beat around the bush about, like, how miserable is your life, really? Like, how many hours do you work? Like, what's it like missing every Christmas and Thanksgiving, you know? And he was just always like, it's not like that.
No, it's not.
Nielsen has signed a long-term contract to work with Marika on the farm. Through DGA, Nielsen has to complete 4,000 hours of training on the job and in the classroom. In return, Marika pays Nielsen a salary and offers bonus incentives. The dairy grazing apprenticeship is the first formal agricultural apprenticeship in the country. It started in Wisconsin, has spread to 10 states, and is registered with the Federal Department of Labor. Joe Tamandel founded the program after seeing more family farms go out of business.
I mean, we just are not seeing the younger generation, the sons and daughters that are interested in coming back to the dairy. So much of that transition of knowledge is not happening. But there are enough people outside of the family that are still looking at coming in and they want a dairy someday.
According to National Young Farmers Coalition, buying land is the biggest obstacle for farmers under the age of 40. Each DGA mentorship is unique, but all mentors are required to pay the apprentices. Some may take the relationship a step further and offer equity in the farm or consider transferring ownership down the line. At Grass Dairy and Uplands Cheese, the apprentice Nielsen says he'd like to one day own his own farm or manage one. The way the business is structured now, there's no way Nielsen could come on as a partner, but Marika says Nielsen has a lot of potential to be a successful farmer, partially because he's gentle with the animals, also because Nielsen is constantly striving to be better.
He really didn't know much about cows, and he probably still doesn't, but it'll come. Because it will come because he wants to learn. And that's the most important foundation for being successful in this business. If you close your mind and you say there's only one way to do this, and you're never striving to get better or realize your own shortfalls, you don't get anywhere. And your business will truly wither and die.
And so much of Nielsen's future is dependent on the knowledge he gains from Marika.
I am a person that asks a ton of questions, probably like 400 questions a day, I think, and I've never, Scott is so patient with me. He almost rarely says, I don't know, which is something I really appreciate about his vast bank of knowledge because...
I'm pretty good BSing.
No, I'm very, very happy. I've actually never been this happy in any job.
You're listening to State of Change on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. If you want to hear more of the State of Change stories from our year-long series on the future of food, water, and land, go to WPR.org/change or subscribe to our podcast, State of Change. We're going to take a quick break, and when we return, cranberry farmers are hoping that Chinese and Indian cultures incorporate more of the tart fruit into their cuisines. Find out why in a couple of minutes. The future of food, water, and land. This is State of Change from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. Cranberries are having their annual moment. They sweetened up the Thanksgiving spread, they shine in the holiday punch, and while the tart fruit does well this time of year, the industry needs consumers to want them more. In recent years, record harvests have outpaced demand, which means Wisconsin cranberry growers are getting less money for their fruit. So, as Rich Kramer reports, farmers are looking for ways to grow demand in new markets.
In late September, more than 100,000 people converged on the tiny village of Warrens for a 3-day celebration of the cranberry. Among the revelers were a group of friends from Green Bay who rode 3 hours by bus to shop and sample the cranberry-laced foods.
Well, we're on our way to get the sausage and the cranberry cheese right over on the corner there. So
and they have cranberry cream puffs. If you try them, they're supposed to be delicious.
But despite the merriment in Warrens, the Wisconsin cranberry industry has faced challenges over the last few years. In 2016, the state saw a record harvest, and this year's projections aren't far behind. That would be a good thing, but demand isn't keeping pace, and prices for fresh fruit have fallen by 20%. So the industry is working to grow new demand in China and India. Tom Lochner of the Wisconsin Cranberry Growers Association says that means introducing the fruit to people who have never heard of it.
We're introducing people to cranberry, so when we go into whether it's Western Europe or UK or Asia, they don't even have words for cranberry. And they don't know what they are, so we have to tell them what the fruit is and then convince them to eat it.
That convincing starts with a bus full of Chinese and Indian business leaders, bloggers, and social media influencers visiting the Cutler Cranberry Farm in Camp Douglas. This is what the U.S. Cranberry Marketing Committee calls a reverse trade mission. The goal is to educate the visitors about how cranberries are grown, harvested, and packed. Then they'll go back home and spread the word. Mabel Zhuang is a consultant for the cranberry industry in China, In 2013, she was part of the first U.S.-branded campaign there.
At that time, we did a survey. Less than 4% of the Chinese consumers are aware of cranberry as a fruit. Compared with a blueberry, strawberry, they have very high awareness rate. But after 5 years promotion, now the awareness rate has increased to over 50%. It's a huge increase in the past 5 years.
This year, the marketing committee made its first moves in India. Ravindra Yadav is an international trade consultant for Technopak Advisors, a contractor for the U.S. cranberry industry. He says only a small percentage of the population has ever heard of the fruit, so he's trying to incorporate it into the local cuisine.
Taking it as a health supplement is absolutely okay. Cranberry juice is picking up. But to, you know, have it as a part of the daily meal, that is a kind of challenge, but I think we are working on it. We have hired a few chefs who would be developing recipes, Indian recipes around cranberries.
After donning waders and walking through a flooded cranberry bed, the delegation toured the processing building at the Cutler Cranberry Company, where berries are dried, sorted, and packed. Seattle-based marketing committee consultant Brooks Erickson helped organize the tour. He says growing demand overseas will take time, but is vitally important.
In terms of for this specific trip, China and India are really huge markets that we've just gotten started in. And I think that for the future health of this industry, it'll be important to continue to invest in them to really increase the demand overseas.
The reverse trade mission cost around $60,000 and was paid for by federal grants and fees paid on each barrel of cranberries. While growers wait for their labors in Asia to bear fruit, they're hopeful the long-term strategy will stabilize the market and improve prices. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin may export more cranberries than any other state, but did you know that the state's ag industry also leads the country in exporting sweet corn, ginseng, and raw skin furs? That's a fancier way of saying farm-raised mink and fox that become coats or hats. Those fun facts come from the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Dan Smith is with DATCAP's Agricultural Development Division, and he gave WPR's Brady Carlson a primer in state agricultural exports.
Dan Smith, welcome to WPR State of Change.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Wisconsin exported some $3.4 billion worth of agriculture products in 2016. The state is 12th in the country in the value of its exports. First, where does that value come in? We're not just talking about raw cranberries and dairy products just kind of heading out into the world, are we?
No. Wisconsin has a very diversified agricultural production system and economy, which allows us to put together various products from different sectors to various markets around the world. And that's really important to the overall economic well-being of Wisconsin's agriculture economy. For instance, China is a big market for Wisconsin lumber exports. Some of that lumber is processed and re-exported out of China, but the majority is staying in the country for new homes and furniture. Some other products. We are also seeing potential growth for value-added products, an important part of Wisconsin's diversified agricultural production, such as ginseng beverages, craft beer, distilled spirits, and specialty dairy products are all growing in demand in the global marketplace.
Exports to China are rising, as you mentioned. Why is that, and what products in particular?
Well, China is obviously a major emerging market for U.S. agricultural exports. As China grows, it is making up a larger share of the global economy. So China will contribute more than one-third of global economic growth this year. Now, China was already a top 10 cheese buyer and is on pace to become the world's largest importer of cheese in the coming year. Along with the lumber that I mentioned and other products that flow into China, China is coming to American agriculture, Wisconsin in particular, to supply the new demand for their rising economic social classes.
One of the exports, and China's not the only country that's getting this from Wisconsin, that caught our attention, bovine genetics. For those who don't know what that means, what is being exported and what is it used for?
Well, four of the world's premier dairy genetic companies are located in Wisconsin. Their research facilities, their livestock, as they harvest semen from those livestock and ship that genetic potential around the world, is a great provider of Wisconsin-type genetics to the livestock industry across the globe.
Is there room for Wisconsin's agriculture sector to grow as an exporter? And if so, what new markets might the state pursue?
Oh, there is definitely room, and it is vitally important that there is that room. Our domestic production, especially in dairy, is exceeding our domestic demand. That gap between what we are supplying and what our domestic customers are demanding has to be filled by export markets. So at the Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection here in Wisconsin, we have a team of five who make up the international trade team. And they travel throughout the world, Latin America, South America, of course, Mexico and Canada, but also Europe, the Middle East, and Asia, building relationships for Wisconsin farmers and Wisconsin businesses around the world so that they understand, our buyers understand, in the other parts of the world, what products that we have, how they are available. And then on this side of the equation, we have the trade organizations as such as the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. We also have the Center for Dairy Research here on campus. All of these organizations are constantly working to make sure that we are producing the type of products in the right packaging, in the right amount, that can address the demand in those areas around the world that the international trade team is visiting.
Dan Smith, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You're listening to State of Change on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. The cycle of supply and demand rules the dairy industry, but some farmers believe there has to be a better way. Hope Kerwin has more on a philosophical split among dairy farmers that could determine the future of the industry.
Like many commodity markets, dairy prices typically rise and fall on a three-year cycle. So when 2014 brought record high milk prices, no one was surprised the market crashed a year later. But dairy analyst Mark Stevenson from the University of Wisconsin-Madison says the industry has been caught off guard by the lack of improvement in prices since then.
There's just a lot of dairy product on the marketplace, and I don't see farmers cutting back very quickly unless prices really go south, and I don't expect that to happen either. So I just think that there's more like this longer, slow bleed this time.
If Wisconsin farmers want better prices, they need to tip the scales of supply and demand back into their favor. But producers don't agree which side of the equation they should focus on.
Well, I think the quick fix would be access to more markets and have some good export numbers happening.
Gordon Spears is a third-generation dairy farmer from Brilliant. He says farmers are constantly improving their cost of production and increasing the amount each cow can produce. That's why milk production has continued to grow around 2% each year, even with low prices. Spears says the industry's only option is to find new markets to keep up with this growth.
We're a victim of our own success. We're making more milk with less inputs, and we need to have a market for that. And export is an excellent opportunity to move those products.
As long as that market's there, there's that opportunity.
Darren Von Ruden is also a third-generation dairy farmer, but he thinks it's the supply side of the equation that's out of balance. Von Ruden says American producers need to stop trying to feed the world and instead focus on creating a more stable market here in the U.S.
You're seeing more and more countries being able to feed themselves rather than depending on the U.S. or another country for food. So if we don't understand that process ourselves as farmers, we're just going to keep overproducing for the needs of our own country and then also not having that foreign market for our product.
Von Ruden says prices would be more stable if the industry had more control over how much milk is produced. And some farmer cooperatives are already doing this. Several Wisconsin co-ops have told members they'll only get a premium price for their average production level. Any milk beyond that would be sold at whatever price the co-op can get. Von Ruden says this system could guarantee farmers have steady prices from the domestic market while still selling extra milk to other countries. But Spears says holding back production is a lost opportunity.
Why would you not want to participate in these other markets and bring foreign money into our own country? We've got a hiccup going on right now for sure, but business is an organism, and organisms are either growing or they're dying.
Dairy analyst Mark Stevenson says a U.S.-centric dairy market would bring more stability for farmers. But it would also mean the industry needs to cut about 10% of the country's current milk production.
It would be a bloodbath getting there. I mean, think about just losing 10% of the dairy industry in a short period of time. Most of the time, we're talking about our prices moving a significant amount based on a 1% change.
Stevenson says the U.S. will likely remain a major exporter of dairy products, so the industry needs to better understand how much they can actually sell to other countries. And fast, because Stevenson says many farmers are taking on more debt while they wait for prices to improve.
That was WPR's Hope Kerwin, and now she's here to tell us more about what all of this means for another part of the dairy industry. Thanks for joining me, Hope.
Glad to be here.
So we heard about how there are differences of opinions on how to deal with milk prices and exports in the conventional dairy market. But does this impact the organic dairy industry at all?
Actually, it does. You know, I talked to someone from Organic Valley. They're one of the largest players in the organic dairy industry, and they're also right here in Wisconsin. And they said people in the organic industry really feel the fates of organic dairy and conventional dairy are tied together. Because when conventional milk prices drop, that creates a larger gap between the prices for conventional dairy products and organic dairy products. And so because Americans, you know, don't want to have to pay more for food, a lot of consumers will think twice before buying organics when conventional prices are really low. So we've definitely seen that pressure in the organic industry with conventional milk prices being so low.
And we've seen the organic dairy industry grow a lot in recent years. Have there been any recent changes in the industry that could really shape its path moving forward?
Yeah, there are definitely two big factors that are influencing the organic dairy industry right now. First, we're seeing more big multinational companies getting into the market. So earlier this year, French dairy company Danone, they acquired the American company WhiteWave, which has the organic dairy brand Horizon. And so to get approval for this acquisition, they had to sell off another of their organic dairy brands, Stonyfield. And they actually sold that to another French dairy company, Lactalis. So we're seeing a lot of these big multinational companies starting to get into the U.S. market. Now, there's also starting to be an oversupply of organic milk in the market for the first time. So around 3 years ago, organic dairy was in such high demand that a lot of companies like Organic Valley, for instance, they were recruiting farmers to make the transition from conventional dairy to organics. Now, that transition takes about 3 years, and so we're at that point where a lot of those producers are coming into the market, and with the addition of these big brands like Danone and Lactalis getting into the U.S. market, we're seeing this oversupply of milk for the first time in organics. It's definitely not as bad as conventional dairy right now, but it's having an impact on producers. And so, like the conventional dairy industry, organic producers are having to make some choices about, you know, how they're going to start to deal with this oversupply. Organic Valley says they're looking at ways to manage milk production from their farmers, and they're also looking at managing how many farmers they're bringing into their cooperative. But they're also looking for ways to expand the market, just like conventional dairy. But unlike conventional dairy, they see the best potential for growth in domestics.
Hope Kerwin is WPR's reporter based in La Crosse. Hope, thanks for all your reporting on this.
Thank you.
You're listening to State of Change on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. Check out more of the stories from our year-long series on the future of food, water, and land online at WPR.org/change. There, you can also subscribe to our podcast, State of Change. We're going to take a super quick break, and when we come back, learn about a tool that predicts future temperatures in Wisconsin. Will it feel like Nebraska, Texas, or Arizona one day? Find out after this. This is State of Change from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. Today, we're looking at the future of food, water, and land. Climate change is one of those things that can be difficult to wrap your head around. It's happening, and yet it's hard to pin a single weather event on it. But one thing scientists can say for sure is that temperature in Wisconsin will rise over the long term. How much? Well, UW-Madison and the State Department of Natural Resources have teamed up to figure that out through the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Through that project, they've created a website that helps Wisconsin residents see changes themselves. WPR News Director Noah Ovshinsky, who might be a little obsessed with this tool, recently walked me through the website. All right, Noah, you've brought me into this studio to show me this website you've been talking about. What are we doing? What are we looking at?
Yeah, so I discovered this website, I guess, a few years ago, and I've been playing around with it since then. And basically, it's a website that scientists at the UW have come up with a map that, depending on where you live in Wisconsin, will show you what your climate or what your temperature will look like in the future. And we can't talk about the future of our, you know, land, water, and food without talking about temperature. So I'm on the website here. Basically, you've got two maps. One is the place where you select the town or the city that you'd like to look at. And then the other map shows you a place elsewhere around the country or elsewhere around the state where that temperature is most likely to be found. And so just for the sake of argument here, I've picked the middle future scenario. I've done the average of the models. So there are about six or seven different climate models you can select. And for the time period, I've picked 2046 through 2065. We'll start there.
So about 30 years from now.
So about 30 years from now. You and I are in Madison. So I'm going to double click on Madison. And I'm going to see where our temperature is going to be in 2046. And on the other map, we can see that.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So starting after 2046, using this sort of average climate model, our temperature will be very similar to an area just north of Springfield, Illinois.
What does that mean?
It's generally warmer. Generally warmer than where we are now. I think that's certainly going to be the biggest takeaway here. You know, snowfall, rain events, those things are a bit more unpredictable, but we do know that it is warmer.
Okay. Let's try another city. Let's try Superior.
Superior, yeah. Let's go up to Superior. So I've clicked on Superior, and we're looking at what the temperature is going to be like in 2046, again, using sort of the average of those climate models. And basically, it's going to look a lot like
West Bend, Wisconsin.
West Bend. So basically, Superior, the far north of Wisconsin.
Always much colder than us
much
here in
colder,
Madison
a lot
in the winter.
A lot more snow. Basically, starting in 2046, looking at an average of the various climate models, because of climate change, the temperature is going to be very similar to West Bend, which is just north of Milwaukee. So a major change for a place like Superior.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So the time frame we've been looking at now is 2046 to 2065. Maureen, let's go even further.
Yeah, let's go.
Yeah, let's look at 2081.
So I'd be almost 100 years old.
And I'll be older. Okay. I'll be older. So let's look at what the temperature is going to be like. And let's look at Madison. So if you look at Madison,
that's taking us to about Columbia, Missouri,
just east of Kansas City.
As someone who lived in central Missouri for a few years, it is much warmer there.
So to bring this full circle, let's go up to Superior and see what Superior is going to look like in this 2081 time period.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at, again, an average of the climate models, we will see it will feel like Milwaukee. This is not, I mean, this isn't the most conservative model. You know, this isn't the other side.
Mm-hmm.
This is an average of the climate models. I think what this map really shows for people is that, you know, our climate is changing. And if you live in Superior, if you live in Madison, if you live elsewhere around the state, the one takeaway here is the temperatures, the climate that we're used to now is not what is going to be in the future. As we just saw in Superior, if we look at 2080, it's going to feel a lot like Milwaukee. That's a big deal.
Noah Ovshinsky is WPR's news director. Thanks so much for showing us these maps.
It was good to be here. Thanks, Maureen.
As Noah said, climate and temperature impact everything around us, and that includes the soil. Wisconsin, like the rest of the United States, has made great strides in soil conservation since the Dust Bowl years of the 1930s. But as Glenn Moberg reports, some of that progress is still being threatened by climate change.
I just blowed in and it got them Dust Bowl blues.
There aren't many people left that still remember the Dust Bowl when drought and poor farming practices led to a loss of millions of acres of topsoil. Historian Jerry Apps grew up on a farm in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin.
I recall from my childhood the dust storms that visited this part of Wisconsin. They were fierce. They were terrible.
Apps says the dust storms led to new conservation practices that still mark the local landscape.
People began seeing the need to plant windbreaks to stop the winds blowing from the west and tearing up the sandy soil and moving it east.
Some scientists say that climate change is bringing back drought and dust storms to the western states. But in Wisconsin, the warming climate is instead producing more frequent heavy rains. That's according to a study by the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, which predicts that the amount of topsoil washed away each year could more than double by 2050.
When you have a 9-inch rain event in 3 hours, is that climate change or is that just weather?
Don Ratke is the farm operations manager at North Central Technical College's Agriculture Center for Excellence, a working farm and hands-on classroom north of Wausau. Ratke worries about the erosion caused when too much rain falls too quickly.
Once the soil is saturated, it's almost like falling on cement or blacktop. It's going to run off.
So was it helpful to see
the students here are learning about erosion. The Ag Center has joined the Soil Health Partnership, an initiative of the National Corn Growers Association. The goal is to improve and preserve topsoil, according to crop science instructor Steve Krieger.
If you have a handful of soil, you've got 10 billion creatures living in it. So if we can put something in the soil, some kind of a root structure, and keep it there, it just makes my 10 billion animals a lot happier because they're the ones that break down the nutrients and make them available for the plants to grow.
Krieger says that by not preserving root structure, some farms are losing 3 tons of topsoil per acre every year.
3 tons is a pretty big pile of soil, correct? So what we're really trying to do is not ship all of our dirt down the Mississippi River and put it in the Delta.
To stop erosion, the Ag Center is teaching the farmers of tomorrow about no-till and cover crop agriculture. Ratke says that means not plowing up the soil and planting a second crop in the fall.
When we take our corn off, we usually put a cover crop of some type on just so there's something always growing in the soil. We try to plant winter wheat, winter rye that'll survive over the winter.
The corn has been harvested from this field at the North Central Technical College farm, but the corn stalk stubble and plant residue has been left in place. And even on this cold November day, you can see green shoots of winter wheat coming up between the rows, a cover crop that will keep the soil from eroding until spring.
We're not digging up soil in fall and we're not digging it up in spring.
The idea is beginning to catch on. John Aaron farms 800 acres in Portage County. He says no-till and cover crops are saving him money.
We want to keep as much nutrients and soil on the land where it's at. Obviously, as a farmer, we don't want to see runoff and see the fertilizer that we've spent money to apply, see that really leave our property.
Steve Krieger says that like the windbreaks that followed the dry Dust Bowl years, new techniques can keep soil in place even if we are heading toward a wetter climate.
When we look back to the great Dust Bowls, you'll see a lot of pine tree rows to try to keep the soil down. What we're doing with this whole process is we're putting something on top of the soil to make sure it doesn't move.
These dusty blues.
And he says that makes sense regardless of what the future holds.
I can't control climate change, but we can control erosion just through our farming practices.
Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
I spent 10 years down in that old Dust Bowl.
You're listening to State of Change on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Maureen McCollum. Wetlands and business have long been at odds with one another. As industry, housing, and agriculture expand, there is pressure to fill swamps, marshes, and bogs. But there are a growing number of companies whose business is restoring wetlands in Wisconsin to make up for what's been lost. Rich Kramer reports on the world of wetland mitigation banking and the challenge of recreating ecosystems that took millennia to develop.
Outside the city of Cornell in Chippewa County, Nick Haas steers a vehicle he calls the Swamp Buggy into a 100-acre wetland known as Foggy Acres.
Do you smell the rotten egg smell?
Yeah.
So the site's only like 5 years old, but you're starting to get some of those, the soil anaerobic conditions returning to the site, so that's the production of sulfide in the soil, and that's the sulfide gas you smell, and that's a good thing.
Many of the native plants are just starting to green up, but the site is bustling with birds, ducks, and a pair of sandhill cranes. It may not look it, but Foggy Acres is actually a business known as a wetland mitigation bank. Here's how it works. A company that wants to fill in a wetland buys credits from a nearby bank, creating what regulators call a net neutral impact. Haas is the project manager for Wisconsin Wetlands LLC, which owns Foggy Acres. He says they've sold credits to utilities, local governments, and frac sand mines for around $50,000 apiece.
In most of the areas, that's around $60,000, so our top would be that, but realistically, we charge between $40 and $60.
There are 13 private mitigation banks like Foggy Acres in Wisconsin, but it's not enough. In fast-developing regions like the Fox Valley, credits quickly sold out. So in 2012, the legislature passed a law creating what's called an in-lieu fee program. DNR Waterway and Wetlands Section Chief Marty Griffin says it allows developers to buy credits before wetland restoration begins.
Instead of having pre-established banks on the landscape or wetland restoration areas, basically you pay into a conservation fund, which then the department puts out requests for proposals to fund projects in the watershed to offset those losses.
The DNR has sold more than $15 million in credits, but none of its five restoration projects have gotten final federal approval to begin. The 2012 law also limited how far companies like Georgia-based Meteor Timber had to look for alternative sites before they destroy wetland. Meteor wants to fill 16 acres of forested wetlands in Jackson County to build a frac sand plant. CEO Chris Mathis says the loss is unavoidable.
Simply put, other sites are either too far away. That would result in the project being uneconomic, and fiduciarily we could not support construction of the project.
To sweeten the deal, Meteor promises to buy mitigation credits and preserve or restore 400 acres of wetlands on other property it owns. But the question remains, does creating or restoring wetlands in one area offset the loss in another? Mitigation bankers and consultants say many projects have been successful, although some in Wisconsin have struggled with invasive plants. And a global study published last year found that restored areas generally only had half of the abundance and one-third of the diversity of plants and animals compared with natural wetlands. Joy Zedler is UW-Madison's Aldo Leopold Chair of Restoration Ecology. She says wetlands are more functional for human well-being than all other ecosystems on Earth.
So wetlands are super important, and they should be held on a very high pinnacle before we decide to go and damage them.
Wetland mitigation is a learning process for all involved, but it's also a political issue. And after President Donald Trump signed an executive order in February repealing a Clean Water Rule enacted during the Obama administration, many are wondering whether requirements to restore wetlands will be around much longer.
That was WPR's Rich Kramer, who now joins me to talk more about wetland mitigation in Wisconsin. Rich, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So can you tell us, has the DNR developed any of the wetland projects that they have the funding for?
Well, not exactly. The DNR hasn't actually broken any ground on wetland restoration projects under the in-lieu fee program, but there are two that are in the works. One is called the Woodland Dunes Natural Area Expansion. The other is the Waukesha County Land Conservancy. Those work out to around 126 acres. There has to be some pre-planning work, mapping of the wetland area before they can get started. They expect that work to be well underway next summer and fall. And the reason it's taking so long is that there needs to be multiple approvals from the Army Corps of Engineers, and that gets really complicated and it takes a long time.
Rich Kramer is WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire. Rich, thanks for all your hard work on this.
Thank you for having me, Maureen.
While people are working to replenish wetlands, others are working to restore former mines. The Flambeau Mine in Ladysmith is the only copper-gold mine to operate in Wisconsin under modern-day mining laws. But the recent repeal of the state's moratorium on sulfide mines may change that. Opponents believe it's impossible to return a site to what it once was after a mine shuts down. Daniel Kading has more on the process to reclaim mines.
Farmfields, trees, and wetlands grace the site where Flambeau Mining Company built its copper-gold mine near Ladysmith in the early 90s. In September, a small group of environmentalists, lawmakers, and residents toured the site where wildflowers, grass, and hiking trails cover what was once an open pit. Ladysmith City Administrator Al Christensen says 90% of the site was reclaimed over a period of months.
When the pit was refilled, the types of material that came out went back in the reverse order. So what was at the bottom went back to the bottom.
The pit was backfilled with waste rock mixed with lime to neutralize any acid from sulfide minerals, which have been known to pollute water if exposed. Reclamation of the site began in 1997 and wrapped up late the next year. Acres of wetlands and thousands of trees and plants were used to replace what was lost. Mining company consultant Steve Donahue with Foth Infrastructure and Environment says there's also been extensive water quality monitoring on site.
The water quality that we see upstream of the mine site is the same water quality in the river that we see downstream, so there's been no effect.
Environmentalists have argued otherwise. A stream on the property that flows into the Flambeau River has shown high levels of copper and zinc. Elevated levels of sulfate, copper, and other metals have also been found in groundwater monitoring wells on site. But hydrogeologist Zoe McManamo with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says there's no evidence that those levels are impacting the Flambeau River's water quality.
Groundwater monitoring parameters that we look for are the ones that are going to be indicative of acid production or mineral migration or any other kind of things that might cause environmental concern.
That monitoring will continue for many years, and as long as it does, the Flambeau Mining Company pays for it. Governor Scott Walker recently signed a bill that lifts the state's sulfide mining moratorium and eliminates a requirement for companies to set aside money indefinitely for long-term care. But McManamo says they would still be liable for any issues. She adds the financial assurance required of companies will be adequate to reclaim sites.
We still have what we call a reclamation bond, which is something that's required prior to the commencement of the mining activity.
She says companies also have to provide funds for long-term care for at least 40 years after closing a mine. That puts Wisconsin somewhere in the middle of how neighboring states regulate mines. In Michigan, companies need to provide financial assurance for half as long after a mine has been reclaimed, according to Joe Mackey with the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
And if we feel the reclamation activities still require monitoring, we can keep extending that for additional 20 years.
Reclamation manager Jennifer Engstrom with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources says they don't put a timeline on when funds can be released.
The only time we release the financial assurance in its entirety is when we have decided that the entire site is fully reclaimed and ready to be released, meaning there's no liability, you know, nothing needs to be done on site.
Otherwise, it can be costly for states to clean up what's left behind if companies can't pay. Across the Midwest, there are 11 abandoned mine lands that have become Superfund sites, according to the U.S. EPA. Taxpayers have spent more than $371 million to clean up those sites alone. The Flambeau Mining Company has finished reclaiming a portion of the mine site. President Dave Klein says they haven't decided when they'll finish restoring the rest of the property. But the Wisconsin DNR is holding on to more than $5 million from the company until the agency confirms the site poses no threat to the environment or human health. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
One big environmental change in Wisconsin continues to be the growth of large animal farms, known as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. The state DNR says there are nearly 300 here, mostly housing dairy cows. Several of the sites have thousands of animals. Some people living near the large farms, especially in areas with highly sensitive soils, complain the spreading of manure from the CAFOs has polluted local drinking water and surface water. Those affected say they're not sure a major state proposal will go far enough. Meanwhile, other farmers are trying to find ways to reduce problems caused by all that manure. Chuck Kornbach reports.
The hot spot for water pollution from CAFOs is Kewaunee County. There, some people say they've become ill from drinking the water. To protect his health, Mick Segrillo, whose small rural property is surrounded by farms, has become more cautious. Segrillo opens and pours from one of the 2 5-gallon drinking water jugs he fills every week at a grocery store 20 miles away in Green Bay. He spends the extra time and about $10 a month on buying water because he's worried that harmful amounts of a chemical compound called nitrate that's in liquid manure have gotten into his well.
There's the deleterious effects of what could possibly happen over time. I don't think erring on the side of caution is being too cautious at all.
Sigrillo says he could spend $15,000 on a deeper well, but he says it's not clear that would be a solution. That's because Sigrillo's home is in a karst region of the state where the soil is shallow and sits over fractured bedrock. It's easier for contaminants to get into the groundwater. The DNR wants to limit the spreading of liquid manure in 15 eastern Wisconsin counties with the shallower soils. But Jody Perrins, a Plan Commission member in the Kewaunee County town of Lincoln, says the state should follow some research results and ban manure spreading on some very thin soil.
They took the science that the administration has been saying for the last 3 years, where we're going to have to make decisions on sound science. Now we have the science, and they threw it out the window.
Some of the large farms in Kewaunee County aren't waiting for the outcome of the rules debate. They're asking the state to allow even more cows at their operations.
Good morning. I'm Tom Baum, and I'm with the CAFO permit program with the Department of Natural Resources.
In late November, the DNR held a hearing in Luxembourg on permit renewals for five CAFOs. Dan Niles was one of the permit seekers. He's co-owner of Dairy Dreams, one of the CAFOs near Mick Sigrillo's house. Niles is also a leader of Peninsula Pride, a coalition that promotes better farming practices. He mostly favors the DNR manure plan.
It's an attempt at tightening up some practices to be more protective of the groundwater. And I think, for the most part, it's a good effort.
But there are farmers willing to try things a different way. Producers such as Jeff Endress, who owns a farm with his brothers near Wanakee.
That would be on the left-hand side is the more fresh manure, and to the farthest to the right is the more finished product.
Endress stands inside a 220-foot-long metal shed that has a roof to keep out moisture and describes four rows of solid manure that he's converting into compost. He says when he spreads the material on his hay fields next summer, a lot of the liquid will be out of the waste and will be less likely to run off and pollute local waterways.
Compost actually absorbs moisture, so it does not leach.
Not all of the waste from the roughly 500 cows here goes into compost. Endress says much of the rest is injected instead of tilled into the soil as another way to reduce runoff. The Endress place is part of a coalition called Yahara Pride Farms, which is trying to improve water quality in the Yahara River watershed. Environmentalists praise the coalition, but say there's no silver bullet for solving manure runoff problems, especially if more dairy farms get really big. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you so much for listening to State of Change, WPR's look at food, water, and land. A huge thanks to all the WPR reporters who contributed to this program today and throughout the year. That's Bridget Bowden, Brady Carlson, Daniel Kading, Hope Kerwin, Rich Kramer, Glenn Moberg, and Chuck Kornbach. Also thanks to our digital team, Andrea Anderson, Jenny Peek, and John K. Wilson for making the content live online. Steve Gotcher handled the sound design. Noah Ovshinsky and Kyla Calvert-Mason helped produce the show. I'm host and executive producer, Maureen McCollum. Go to our website, WPR.org/change, to hear more of the stories from our year-long series. You can also subscribe to our podcast, State of Change.